You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Christodoulou. David Brooks is a columnist for the New York Times, and in the words of rival paper, The Washington Post, he's one of the most prominent public intellectuals of our time. He's the author of wildly influential books combining keen analysis with insights from social science, like Bobos in Paradise and The Social Animal. He's got a new book out called How to Know a Person. It's a guide to fostering deeper connections by truly learning how to see and understand others, and be seen and understood in turn. We brought him together with the journalist and storytelling expert Will Storr. If their conversation sounds like something you're really going to enjoy, take a look at our festival coming up in January. It's called How to Change Your Life and stars many past How To Academy guests in the psychology, health and well-being space, including Ruby Wax, Tim Spector, David Nutt, and many more. Full details on our website. But that's enough from me. Here are David Brooks and Will Storr.
It's such a pleasure to be here chatting with you, David. It's a real honour. You know, I've been a huge fan, and I thought How to Know a Person was just wonderful. It's fascinating, but also a compassionate book and quite a vulnerable book. You really do give something of yourself in this book.
Yeah, I didn't start out that way, but my first, I should say, I'm pleased and honored to be here with you. I've learned a lot from you. I've read and really admired The Science of Storytelling right here, The Science of Storytelling. And yeah, so people, my readers, my initial readers said, you know, you got to put yourself in the book. And so as the process went on, as they hammered that, you know, you have to, if you're going to write a book about how to know a person, then if you're, it's not personal, then there's something wrong here. So I made it more about partly a little journey that I took and partly a journey that we're all taking. And, you know, the little journey I took was, I start the book by saying, if you ever saw that movie Fiddler on the Roof, you know how warm and huggy Jewish families can be. And I come from the other kind of Jewish family, super cerebral. And I don't know if this is insulting to Brits, but the culture in our, the name of our culture was Think Yiddish, Act British. Mm. And so we were reserved. And so if you came to our house for dinner, you might hear a conversation about the history of Victorian funerary monuments or something like that, the evolutionary sources of lactose intolerance. But you wouldn't see us like telling each other we loved each other. You wouldn't see a lot of emotional vulnerability. So I needed to grow up from that.
So, yeah, I mean, you write about that quite movingly in the book about, and you say that, you know, there was a family that didn't really express love and that growing up, you were quite aloof socially. You're an observer, which, of course, tends to make for a great journalist. And so earlier on in your life, how did that kind of Britishness and the kind of aloofness, how did that sort of impact you personally and socially?
Yeah, I mean, I tell journalism students, if you're at a football game and everyone is doing the wave, and you don't do the wave, you just sit there, then you have the right kind of aloof personality style to be a journalist. we indeed don't do anything. We watch people do stuff. And so I think it helped me professionally, frankly. I was an observer, but it hurt me personally in that, you know, I think I wasn't great at cultivating friendships. I was the sort of person who few people would confide in me. I didn't send in those vibe that you can really come to me with your problem. And I think it was people had a tough time knowing what I thought of them, and they had a tough time knowing me. I literally just 2 days ago had a conversation with a guy who was, his daughter was in my son's elementary school class. And he said, I used to think you're so, well, he mentioned what a lot of people mentioned to me, you're so different now. And he said, I used to think you really disliked me.
Oh.
I was like, no, I never had any negative thought, but I think I just projected. I mean, the kind of attention you cast on the world determines your way of being in the world. And if you cast sort of a cold and rational form of attention, people are going to think you're cool and unfriendly and you don't like them. But if you cast a warm gaze, then there's something about that brings out growth in people. And so the power of our gaze is just tremendous in shaping how people interpret us and how we see the world.
Yeah, there's this great quote at the beginning of your book. I just got to read the quote quickly. He says that there's one skill that lies at the heart of any healthy person, family, school, community organization, or society. The ability to see someone else deeply and make them feel seen, to accurately know another person, to make them, to let them feel valued, heard, and understood. That is at the heart of being a good person, the ultimate gift you can give to your to others and to yourself. You know, that's a really profound thing to say. And I wonder if you could sort of dig into that, because obviously that's the heart of the book, it's the heart of your argument. I wonder if you could expand on that. And particularly because, you know, when I'm reading it, I'm thinking, is this just empathy? Is this a book about empathy, or is it deeper and richer than that?
Yeah, I think it's deeper than empathy. People misunderstand empathy. To me, empathy is three different skills, so we put it to one phrase. The first skill is mirroring, catching the emotion that you are catching. So I'm sharing your emotion, whatever you're projecting. The second is mentalizing. It's me being, well, I've had an experience similar to what he's going through, and so I sort of know what he's thinking. If it's your first day on the job, I sort of know what it's like to be first day on the job. And then the final is caring. And so we say con men are really good at reading other people's minds, but we wouldn't say they're empathetic because they don't care. And so you got to be effective caring. So there's a little story in the book, one of my little favorites, I heard it from a rabbi, Elliot Kukla is his name. And he said he had a congregant who had suffered a brain injury, and she would sometimes just fall on the floor. And she just fell on the floor. And she said, people always rush to lift me up from the floor because they find it so uncomfortable to see an adult on the ground. But sometimes I just want somebody to get down on the ground with me. And so that's empathy, knowing not what would make you comfortable, but would make the other person comfortable. And so empathy is a key here. But I don't think when I talk about seeing someone else deeply, I mean more than just empathy. So if I want to see you deeply, I really, you know, one of the things I learned from the science of storytelling is we all walk around with these models in our head of how we see reality. And if I want to see you deeply, I want to see a little how you see the world. And so I probably have to know a little about your personality type, which is knowing about how personalities work. I probably have to know a little about your ethnic heritage and how it's shaped how you see the world. I ideally would like to know about moments of suffering and how they've shaped how you see the world, whether you see with trusting eyes or distrustful eyes, traumatized eyes, or just light and carefree eyes. And so it's beyond just empathy, and it involves a whole body connection, including an intellectual understanding of your models.
Yeah, so it's obviously much, much deeper and much, much richer. And as you say, it's at the, you know, it's at the heart of being a good person. Is this kind of model that you outline of, you know, seeing a person deeply. I mean, as you're talking, I'm thinking about there's the famous Coolidge definition of the self, and that phrase, the mirror self that he talks about, where he says that we are who we think other people think we are. And when you were speaking earlier about your who you used to be a bit more, the aloof person who people felt you didn't like them very much, and that you were maybe judging them from a distance. Do you think that then rebounded to your own self view? Did that affect how you perceived yourself? Mm. That perception?
Yeah, I would say I was just not. No, I probably, my ego was fine. I think what had changed was that I think I knew I had emotions, but I wasn't particularly familiar with them. And they certainly did not, there was no road between my heart and my mouth. So I was not good at expressing the emotion. And so I think it was a process of becoming less emotionally reserved. And a process of becoming familiar with emotion and familiar with expressing emotion. And frankly, when somebody comes to me with, I'm having a problem in my marriage, or I'm having a trouble with my friendship, I don't panic. And so part of that is literally knowing the skills. You have to be open-hearted to do this, but you just have to know a set of social skills. Like, how do you sit with someone who is suffering from depression? How do you sit with someone who's lost a loved one? How do you be a great conversationalist? How do you even end a conversation well? Like, I just thought, like, how should you end a conversation so it doesn't feel awkward? When I went to my first school reunion, it was the fifth reunion, and I didn't know how to get out of conversation gracefully. And the only go-to move I had was, I'm going to get another drink at the bar.
The classic, yeah.
So in 45 minutes into that reunion, I am so drunk out of my mind that I have to leave, so I go home. And I just didn't know how. So, you know, if you want to end a conversation gracefully, say, you know, I've really enjoyed talking with you. I'm particularly fascinated by what you said about X. Pick something specific and then say, it's been wonderful being with you. And that way you're ending a conversation by putting a little cherry on top of it.
Yeah.
And it's just a little technique. And so these are skills, and the book tries to teach skills. And my assertion is that social skills are like carpentry or tennis. They're skills one can learn. We're all born with a certain level of athletic ability in social life, but we can all get better, and nobody's good without practice.
Absolutely. I mean, you also tell the story about how you changed from being this kind of, you could call it blocked, you know, younger person, and to the extent that even Oprah Winfrey herself commented on how much you changed from one period of your life to another. Can you talk us through how you changed, you know, what about you changed, but also what was the process? What actually happened in your life to enable you to change?
Yeah, I think it was a gradual process, at which I would start way back 2008, maybe, because I went to the University of Chicago. I wanted to learn about emotion. I wanted to be more emotional. So I wrote a book about emotion. and I sort of taught myself about emotion. And then around 2013, I went through a hard season in life. My kids were going off to school, university, and my marriage had dissolved. And I was sort of in a spot where I realized I was living in some dingy little apartment. And I did what any male idiot would do when presented with a hard time in life, which was I tried to work my way through it, just be a workaholic. And so if you had gone into my drawer in the kitchen, I wasn't inviting anybody over for dinner. So in that drawer, there were just post-it notes where there should have been silverware. And where there should have been plates, there was envelopes and other stationery. And so that symbolized to me a sort of life that I had a lot of work friends, but I didn't have those weekend friends. So it was like 2 a.m, who are you going to call friends? And so I was lonely and realizing there was some set of bad values I had been living by. And so I just went through this dark period. And there's a Paul Tillich phrase, moments of suffering interrupt your life and remind you you're not the person you thought you were.
Wow.
They carve through the floor of the basement of your soul and reveal a cavity below. And they carve through that floor and reveal a cavity below. So in those hard moments, we just become more deeply aware of who we are. And I realized that only spiritual and relational food would fill that. And then I sort of got adopted by a family. And I say family, I use the word advisedly. It was 2 couples and then about 40 teenagers. And so they were sort of a chosen family, mostly for teenagers who had some disruption in their own family lives. And I went out to dinner with I went to dinner with this group of probably a bunch of teenagers and a few adults every Thursday. For about 6 years, we did our holidays together. We did vacations together. And those kids were like, they were like sunflowers, just turning their beam of attention and demanding emotional availability from you.
Wow.
And they really modeled for me a way of being. So I got to the point, like hugging and all this kind of stuff, like just like being open. And so I got to the point where I was at a conference about a year or two ago, and they handed us lyric sheet of a love song. And they said, pick a stranger and sing this love song to his eyes.
Oh.
And so if you had asked my former self, I would have spontaneously exploded.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did it. I did. I found some stranger. I sang a love song into his eyes.
And how was that?
It was not the best thing in the world, but I did it.
Yeah. But you did it. You got through it. And you know, you found that you've become a better, more rounded, more emotional, more social person.
Yeah, and I think it really is, it's like anything, when you know the skills, you know, you feel comfortable in the arena.
Yeah.
And so knowing how to sit with someone, like I described in the book, sitting with my friend who was depressed, like, how do you do that? How do you become a great conversationalist? What, you know, how do you ask for questions in the right order? Like, when I first meet somebody, you don't want to ask a deep question. So I often ask, like, where are you from? Because I travel a lot, so I know a lot of childhood things. Or I ask them, where'd you get your name? And that gets people talking about their ethnic background. When talking politics, I never ask anymore, what do you think? I ask, how did you come to believe that? And that way they're telling me a story about some experience they had or somebody who shaped their values. And I have a friend who's in London right now who lives there. And I asked him just in a small group, we were just fooling around having a drink. What's your favorite unimportant thing about yourself?
Oh, that's lovely.
And he's like an impressive theologian, so I thought, oh, wow, he's going to have something. But he watches way too much trashy reality TV, so that was his favorite unimportant thing about himself.
Is what you're describing, because in the book you write about conversing with somebody in the narrative mode rather than the kind of standard mode of maybe asking closed questions. Is this what you're describing here?
Yeah, so that's one way of trying to get them into narrative mode. And one of my favorite stories is, I got it from another book called You're Not Listening by a writer named Kate Murphy. And she describes this focus group person and moderator who had been hired by grocery stores to figure out why people come to the grocery stores late at night. And she doesn't ask the question that way. Instead, she takes the focus group and says, tell me about the last time you went to the grocery store after 11 p.m. And there's some quiet lady who hadn't said anything in the whole focus group said, well, I'd smoked a joint and I wanted a menage a trois with me, Ben and Jerry. And so she tells a little story. And so you're getting a little window into her life. And it's a better way to ask questions.
It's a much more vivid way of meeting somebody, isn't it? Like you really feel, you really get a feel for who they are in a much kind of better way.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So just sort of talking again about the journey that you've been on through your life. You've said elsewhere in another piece, I think it was an interview with you, where you say, when I look at videos of my earlier self, I think, wow, I'm really not that guy anymore, which is a good thing, although I suffer a lot more. I was much happier when I was super shallow. I didn't have any bad emotions. I wasn't sad in the morning. So it's kind of good. I'm so pleased to be shallow. Now I'm burdened with the world problems. So it's interesting because it doesn't sound all that good. Like it's not an unalloyed benefit, this kind of program that you're, that you're promoting.
Yeah, my next book is How to Go Back to Being Extremely Shallow. Basically, it's going to be called Goldfish. I'm reminded of that question. I have been teaching on and off at American universities, and my courses, one of them was about how to make the big commitments in life. And it was for 21-year-olds. And it really was, my students all just called it therapy with Brooks because we just spilled our guts to each other. One of my students, one of my best students who had just been awarded a Rhodes Scholarship, says to me, you know, Professor Brooks, I really enjoyed the class. It's made me much sadder. and I took that as a win because here was this superstar guy who hadn't done much reflection upon himself. I have more feelings and I have more feelings of sadness, but I also have more feelings of joy and happiness. And I also have, wonderful relationship with my wife, and we just had Thanksgiving here in the States, and my wife said, my attitude toward my kids is way different than it used to be, and my posture toward them. So, one of my heroes is a novelist named Frederick Buechner, and he says, what we want most in life is to be seen in our fullness.
Yeah.
And what we fear most is to be seen in our fullness. But his life, which is sort of a model for mine, was really a life of emotional repression to a life of emotional engagement. And I wouldn't want to go back. I wouldn't want to be this lone, no man is an island. So I wouldn't want to go back and be the island.
I wanted to, because we've both had similar backgrounds in that we're both journalists. I've spent years meeting a huge array of people and really, spending good 3 or 4 hour hours with me, an intense conversation. And I certainly believe it's changed my life. It's changed how I see other people. It has massively increased my sense of, I feel just sort of my understanding that you can be very wrong about other people and that you can misunderstand them. And, I know we're not strictly talking about empathy here, but it's definitely increased my sense of empathy with other people. It's taught me a lot about the vast range of experience there is around the world, and that people that you might dismiss as being stupid or ignorant over a tweet are actually coming from a place of complete sincerity in a place that you might not quite understand. I mean, has that been your experience too? Because I feel like reading How to Know a Person, that this is, it almost feels like the book by a seasoned journalist, a person who's been around the world and met a lot of people and had that, a similar kind of almost brutal education in this is what it's like to be a human.
Yeah, no, I'm very proud of our profession because, you know, academics do studies. Mm. And I rely on a lot of studies. And I have learned a lot from studies. And studies are great for understanding populations of people. But journalism, our gold standard is the interview. It's we ask people questions. And I think that's the way to understand each particular person. Because every individual is more fascinating than the studies you read about groups of people. And so, like, I heard about a woman who was at a Trump rally, and she was a lesbian biker who converted to Sufi Islam after surviving a plane crash. And so, like, what stereotype does she fit into? She is not your typical Trump, but nobody is your typical Trump supporter, your triple labor supporter or whatever. Everybody's more interesting than their stereotype. And one of the great sins we do is called stacking, which is when you learn one fact about a person, you make a whole series of assumptions about who they must also be. And stacking is really a terrible way to, you know, miss the truth and not see someone. And so I thank you for, because we do a lot of journalism. And when I put this question to you, I would say in my career as a journalist, basically 35 years of asking people questions about them, how many times have they said to me, "None of your damn business"? And if I've found the answer is zero, and if you ask people respectfully about their life story, they're dying to tell you their life story, and that nobody's ever asked them. I don't know if your experience is very different than that.
It is the same, except with the caveat that which is the most depressing form of journalism there is. I used to sometimes have to interview celebrities, so. Believe me, asking Katy Perry about her marriage problems with Russell Brand is going to get you none of your damn business. But with that, which is awful, you know, like you feel so awful as the journalist asking those nosy questions. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. When it's non-celebrity, 100% of the time, people want to talk to you about this stuff. They want to tell you their story. And that's, again, something else you write about in How to Know a Person, that's what we want. You know, people love to tell their story. And actually, as you also write, you know, one of the things that journalists and also therapists do is they help people compose their narrative. You know, you can feel yourself when you're in a deep conversation with somebody, you're helping them make sense of this crazy thing, that journey that they've been on, that you're talking to them about.
Yeah, you know, very few of us, unless we're memoirists, sit down and consciously write our life story. We get to compose it as when somebody asks us. And so what therapists are, I learned this from a therapist named Lori Gottlieb, therapists are story editors. Usually people come to therapy because their story isn't working, often because they get causation wrong. They blame themselves for things that are not their fault, and they blame others for things that are their fault. And so in therapy, they go over and over with the therapist, and the therapist is like, "Well, didn't you leave that out?" And they try to get them to tell a story in which the patient has agency, when the patient has power.
Oh, interesting.
And everything a therapist does, a friend can do. And therapists, I learned this through the book. I thought they would have some special curriculum on how to know another person, but no, they've been around the block a few times. And so they've seen so many people, they're usually a couple steps ahead. But any friend can do that too, just by saying, "Is that really part of your story? Is that really what you want?" And so when I'm listening to stories, I'm wanting to know, like, who's the hero here?
Yeah.
Like, how do they portray themselves? Like, some people are the fighter. Some people are the healer. I think I'm the student. I think we all have an interview style. Like, my style is more, I'm a student, educate me. Some people are seducers in an interview, but I'm the student. So I want to hear what their social role is. And then I want to hear, like, what's the plot here? How do they describe the narrative of their lives? And there's a guy who studies this at Northwestern named Dan McAdams. Mm. And he wrote a book called The Redemptive Self. And his argument was that most of us tell stories as redemption stories. Mm. We were on the path. Something bad happened. We came back better. We were redeemed. And so he writes this book. And then he travels around the world. And I don't know if it's true in the UK, but he's traveling around the world saying, we tell stories as redemption stories. And a lot of parts of the world, people look at him like, what are you talking about? That's how Americans tell their lives. That's not how we tell our lives. And so other people have different plots in their culture that they tell their lives by.
I think it's a very Western, I think it comes out of ancient Greece, that I think it's very Western, I think definitely in the UK, because I read The Redemptive Self too, and that was one of my criticisms of it, really. This is not just America, this is the West. This is a story of Western individualism. This is the story. Yeah, so that was my takeaway. I think that's a very Western individualist tale that, this individual encountered this obstacle and I overcame it and victory was mine, or of course, disaster and failure was mine. Yeah. One of the really fascinating ideas, and I think really useful ideas that you explore in your book, is this concept of diminishers versus illuminators. I wonder if you can sort of describe that for us.
Yeah. So a diminisher is someone who makes you feel unseen. So he's not curious about you. He stereotypes, he ignores, he's all about himself. And you leave those people thinking, like, I have now have a rule. If you invite me out to coffee and you lecture at me for 40 minutes without ever asking me a question or really being concerned that I exist, we will not be enjoying each other's company again. So I've just... They're diminishers. There's just nothing you can do about it. They're so into themselves. And illuminators are people who are curious about you. They ask about you and they look at you with eyes of respect and reverence, and they invite you to really present your full and best self. And so two little illuminator stories I tell. One is about the novelist E.M. Forster, who wrote about 100 some odd years ago, I guess. And his biographer wrote to him to be with Forster was to be seduced by an inverse charisma. He listened to you with such intensity, you had to be your best, most honest, and sharpest self.
Wow.
And who wouldn't want to listen with that kind of intensity? And another story I tell is possibly apocryphal, but it makes a point. And it's told about Jenny Jerome, who would go on to become the mother of Winston Churchill. And she's having dinner in late 19th century England. And one night she's seated next to William Gladstone, the prime minister. And she leaves that dinner thinking that Gladstone is the cleverest person in England. Then sometime later, she's at another dinner and she happens to be seated next to Gladstone's great rival, Benjamin Disraeli. And she leaves dinner with Disraeli thinking that she's the cleverest person in England. So the rule is it's good to be Gladstone, but it's better to be Disraeli, to listen to people so they feel like they're walking on air when they leave you.
That's right. You give status. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, yeah. And so do you think you've always been an illuminator? Do you think you've had... We were once a diminisher. Do you think it's a something that we can learn, or do you think it's a personality thing? Like, are neurotics more diminishers? Like, how does that all work?
I think it's definitely about focusing your attention. One of the heroes of the book is Iris Murdoch, the novelist and philosopher, and she says most of the times we look at each other with selfish eyes. We look at others as an object that we're going to use, or some instrumental or transactional way. But she says our goal should be to cast a just and loving attention on others, to cast a gaze of respect and reverence, that we're going to see people for who they are, see them involved in a noble struggle. And that just and loving attention is a more gracious way of being in the world, a more generous way of being in the world. There's a phrase, every epistemology implies an ethic. The way you know the world implies your moral way of being in the world. And so you'd think I'd be a regular old Sigmund Freud after 4 years working on this book. And, I have my moments, but then I have a couple glasses of wine at a dinner party and I start blabbing funny stories about myself. Or, it's late at night and I'm on a plane and I put my headphones in. I don't want to talk to a person. But more the average of my behavior is more. So, even riding on a train or a bus or a plane, I'm way more likely to talk to the stranger than I would have been before doing this, because I learned from research how much fun it is. And that's certainly been born out of my life. So that's one concrete way my life has changed. I now talk to the strangers that are sitting next to me at a bar or something like that.
And hopefully leave them feeling like they're the smartest person in the world.
Yeah. Right. And so, some of the times they, I do this, especially when I'm in a very Trump-centered part of America. I call it reporting. You would call it going to a bar and hanging out. But I'm terrified they're going to ask me where I work, because I'm going to say, I work at the New York Times. And then the conversation's about to go south big time. But they never do. So
Good.
That's one point when you get self-absorbed people, they don't think to ask, what do you do?
Yes. So they'd be stacking you back, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. you've gone through a very unusual journey. I think it's unusual, converting from Judaism to Christianity. How has this shift in worldview, shift in almost moral reality impacted the intellectual journey that you describe in the book?
Yeah, I think of it more as coming to faith, coming from 40 years of atheism to coming to believe in God.
Okay.
And so I grew up in a Jewish home. Mm. I was sent to an Episcopal school. And because it was New York City, I was in the choir and 40% of us were Jewish. And so we would sing the hymns, but we wouldn't sing the word Jesus to square it with our religion. So the volume would drop in the church and then go on. But it was just two stories. I didn't believe in God. So it didn't seem, they were just two good wisdom traditions, really. But then round about age 50 or late 40s, my categories for reality didn't match the reality I perceived. Mm. I didn't have categories to match the occasional moments of transcendence, the feeling of an undercurrent of divine love. And mostly, you know, if you know anything about New York, you know, the ugliest spot in New York is Penn Station, the train station there.
Yeah.
Well, it's the second ugliest spot. The actual ugliest spot is the subway station next to Penn Station.
Right.
And so one day I'm there in this crowded subway station, and it occurs to me that all these people have souls. That there's some piece of them that has no size, weight, color, or shape, but gives them infinite value and dignity. Mm. And that we're not all equal on the level of our brain power or muscle power, but we're all equal on the level of our souls. Mm. And you know, so their souls are yearning, or some people have souls that are sick, and some people have souls that are in raptures, and that there's some spiritual essence to everybody you meet. And so I do think it led to this book in some way, because it means that every person I meet is made in the image of God. Every person I meet, I'm staring into the face of God. And I'm trying to love them. The ideal of human love is the way God knows us and the way God sees us, which is not a cold, detached gaze. It's a loving embrace. And so I think coming to faith influenced the book, that the book's not religious in any real way, just because my belief is that having respect and reverence for every human soul you encounter, whether it's the person in the bar, the person at the cash out, the check cashier, the homeless person on the ground, that's a precondition for seeing them well.
Hello, it's Vas here, recommending you a new book from our friends at Firm Press. This May, the author of The Argonauts and other genre-defying, unclassifiable modern classics, Maggie Nelson, is back with a new collection of essays. It's called Like Love. The collection celebrates art, artists, and thinkers, including Prince, Bjork, Sarah Lucas, and Judith Butler. Like Love is available to pre-order now in hardback, ebook, and audio.
Yeah, there's some beautiful writing in the book about this. I loved when you were writing about how even if you're atheist, you should treat everybody as if they have a soul. I thought that was really moving and, you know, very true. So yeah, I think it's very clever how you can certainly feel what you've just said. You can feel your Christian reality in the book. But it's not by any means a Christian book. It's you don't talk about that, you know, at the side of you very much at all. You do touch upon some themes which you've written about in other places, and that includes some dismaying changes that have happened in the US and by extension across the West. You know, we give less to charity these days. We're ruder. We're more depressed. We are, as is well known, very much more lonely and more isolated. So, you know, what's your diagnosis? And also, presumably this is all part of your argument that we're all feeling less known in a way. And if we're all feeling less known, then what impact is this having upon politics and society?
Yeah, well, as I was becoming more human a little, I think our societies are becoming more dehumanized. Mm. And the forces of dehumanization are many. I think social media has played a role. Politics and political polarization, I think we in the media have played a role. I think we've discovered in the internet age, in order to attract eyeballs, we have to generate fear and anger.
Yeah.
And so we've set a public culture that is much nastier.
Yeah.
And it's just a fact that when we evolved to live in bands of 150 people, and we only felt safe when people around us were seeing us.
Yeah.
And if when we have a sense that nobody's seeing us, we're invisible, then there's going to be a sense of existential anxiety. And of course, you're going to lash out. And so I think a sadder society and a lonelier society becomes a meaner society. And so I had a guy, a restaurateur in New York, tell me he has to kick people out of his restaurant every week now for rude behavior. He said that never used to happen. My sister-in-law is a nurse, and she says our trouble at the hospital is keeping staff. People, the patients have become so abusive, the nurses burn out, want to leave the profession. And so there's just been this uptick of meanness and hate crimes at a time as our societies are becoming incredibly diverse. And so you walk down the street in London or in New York or in Paris or wherever, what you see is incredible cultural diversity. And we did not evolve to live with this diversity. We evolved to live with people just like us. And it's just harder to understand somebody who grew up in China or India or Kenya, but it's worth it. And it's doable. One of the things that I really disagree with is this thing called standpoint epistemology. You can't know unless you've lived my experience, you can't know me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just think it's wrong. There was a beautiful book piece written in the New York Review of Books by Zadie Smith. And she recalled that when she would go into her friends' homes as a kid, she would tell herself stories. What would happen if I came into this home and I never left, if I joined this family? What would it be like to be Ghanaian or Swiss or Dutch? And she would tell this beautiful way to sort of get yourself in the minds of a different cultures. And I remember when I read that, I thought, what a great way to train yourself to see others across difference. I also thought, thank God I didn't become a novelist because I can't compete with that.
But that's true, isn't it? I mean, this, you know, standpoint epistemology. I mean, if you're going to sign up to that, then throw away all your novels because that's what a novelist does. And a novelist imagines themselves into the life of another person. You know, maybe their first novel is a thinly disguised autobiography, but right. You're going to run out of that material pretty quickly. And yeah, it seems to me that that's just another manifestation of xenophobia. It's another manifestation of get off my land, get out of my intellectual tribal space. I agree. I think it's an inherently toxic idea, and I think it comes out of xenophobia. It's just a fashionable manifestation of it. We're coming to the end of our time. I want to talk quickly about generativity because that's a really important idea that comes towards the end of the book. You know, what is generativity? Why is it important? How do we do it?
Yeah, that chapter is on one of the things. If I'm going to know you, I should know what life task you're in the middle of. So kids are in the middle of proving they have efficacy. It's called industry versus, I forget. It's little boys or little girls need to show I can do stuff. And so that's their life task. Then when we get to be adolescents or teenagers, we're in an interpersonal phase where what really matters to us is our friendships and our peers really define us. And we almost don't have a self without the peers. And then in middle age, many of us have a life task of career consolidation, which is I'm trying to make it in the world. And when we're in that life task, we tend to close up a little emotionally. Mm. And then I think sometime at age 50 or 60, there's this generativity instinct that really seizes people. And I tell college students, you know how when you were 13 or 14 or 15, the sex drive just suddenly appeared, you suddenly became horny all the time? Something happens to old people at 60. They become horny to give back. And they want to give back. And so generativity is this obligation that I think a lot of old people feel that I need to leave something behind for the next generation. It's the self, a lot of that self-aggrandizement is just stale to me now. And I measure myself by my surrender. And so I'm actually teaching a class this spring in Chicago with my wife for people age 50 to 70 of how they move from their career to their next third of their life.
Wow.
And and I've been interviewing people going through the middle of this process. And it's a whole change in consciousness. It's really a change of like, I'm driving, I'm acquiring, I'm building, I'm instrumental. And it's a change to I'm a servant. I can fail big. I mean, I had a woman who was a prosecutor and now she wrote a play about Anne Boleyn, Henry VIII's wife. And she said, I could fail big. Who gives a crap? I'm 65. And so that's like a freeing, a liberated attitude. And so I think that transition to generativity is a beautiful one, but sometimes a hard one. And I write in the book, I'm in the middle, sort of stuck halfway, because I wrote this book, The Second Mountain, about how little you should care about money and material things. So I'm still wound up checking my Amazon ranking every hour to see how I was selling. So I've got a long way to go.
Yeah. It's hard. But it's interesting because, you know, it makes me think about what evolutionary psychology, where they find about the role of grandparents in the tribes that we grew up in. The grandparents were instrumental in the raising of the children. And it was much more about the expression of wisdom, the expression of these are the rules of the tribe, these are the things you need to learn about, the bigger, you know, life's bigger picture. And so, so you do wonder if that's connected, this shifting consciousness that you describe, where we sort of go into this very ancient grandparent mode.
Yeah, I definitely think that. You know, when I would ask my students to write papers about the people who really formed them or really knew them, the number one type of answer I would get were grandparents. Nobody ever mentioned their own parents, but they mentioned their grandparents. As this person was the wise person who really led me, and this person, you know, wisdom is not like just uttering maxims.
Yeah,
I have a section in the book that wisdom is about the ability to be tenderly receptive, to get the story someone is telling them and hear them even more honestly than they may have told it. And so, a quick little example of that is, if anybody remembers the movie Good Will Hunting. Mm-hmm. Matt Damon plays a math whiz, and Robin Williams plays a therapist. And Matt Damon rips to shreds Robin Williams' whole persona. And he pulls him out to a pond the next day, and he says, you know, the Robin Williams character says, when I look at you, I don't see a confident man. I see a scared kid. Unless you want to talk about, and there's nothing from about you I can't learn from some book. And then he says, unless you want to talk about you, who you are, then I'd be fascinated. But you don't want to do that because you're terrified of what you might say. And that, to me, is a speech born of great wisdom, because first he's heard the thing the Matt Damon character has spent the whole movie trying to hide, which is he's terrified by life. Mm. And he said, I know this about you. I put it on the table. It's going to be okay. And then he gives them a direction in which to grow. As the phrase goes, let other people voluntarily evolve. Don't try to change them. And so he says, there are two kinds of knowledge in the world. There's the kind you can get from books, which is important. We write them. and then there's the kind of knowledge you get from living, from suffering, from having a relationship and getting dumped by being in a war. And he says to him, you lack the second kind of knowledge, personal knowledge. And so he really is critiquing with care and just saying, here's what you need. And so that's, to me, that speech is an example of great tender receptivity, really hearing the struggle the other person is going through.
Yeah, I mean, that was really the sort of the final, really profound argument you make in the book, this redefinition of wisdom from, you know, as you're right, we traditionally see wise people as being like Yoda or Dumbledore, you know, they're up on the, you know, with a great beam from heaven giving out lessons from life. But actually, it's not about that. It's about something else. So I think that was a really sort of beautiful way of kind of closing the book. And just in our final sort of couple of minutes, I just wonder if you could sort of wrap it all up by, you know, if you wanted to really distill it down into its essence, what are the kind of three or four big sort of takeaway points you want people to know? Like, if you want to answer the question, how do we really know a person? What are the three or four things that we need to sort of go away and really build into our lives?
Yeah. Well, the first is the gaze.
Yeah.
And I tell the story in the book of a guy named, I'm having breakfast in Waco, Texas, and with a 93-year-old lady named LaRue Dorsey. And there's a mutual friend of ours walks in the diner and sees her. And she's been presenting herself to me like a drill sergeant, this stern disciplinarian, tough lady. And he goes up to her, grabs her by the shoulder, and shakes her way harder than you should shake a 93-year-old, and says, Mrs. Dorsey, you're the best, I love you. And that stern disciplinarian I'd been talking to turned into a bright, eye-shining 9-year-old girl.
Wow.
And so the lesson is the power of attention. Just how do you gaze upon the world? How do you attend to the world? The second thing is just the power of great conversation.
Yeah.
That it's easy to have mediocre conversations. We do it all the time. But to have a memorable conversation. And when you were talking about the diversity, you know, I was thinking, I once had a great conversation recently, right here, I'm sitting in my living room, and we asked in the middle, how do your ancestors show up in your life? Mm. So how does your Dutch heritage show up? How does your Black heritage, a couple of Black or Jewish heritage? Mm. If this 5 years in your life is a chapter, what's this chapter about? And I had a guy who's an 80-year-old political scientist. We were at dinner with like six people, and he said, I probably got one project in me. What should it be? And that started a conversation about his interests, his passions, but also about old age, how to die well. And it was these bigger conversations just open up. and the process of really getting to know someone. So it's being that skilled at conversation.
Great. Oh, well, it's been wonderful talking to you, David. We're going to move on to some questions now from the audience, which I should, if this has worked, have been sent. From Andrew. As many of the skills you discuss tend to be acquired over time, do you have any suggestions for authentically learning or applying them at pace? Like getting there quickly, I think he's trying to say.
I do think they are acquired over time, but I think a lot of them should be taught in schools. Like, I think in age 15, there should be a class in like just basic social skills, like the ones I've mentioned before. How do you end a conversation gracefully? Mm. How do you ask a person out? How do you break up with them without crushing their heart? So young people have had these skills, who've had the ability to say, know how to break up with someone, or know how to treat a teacher with the right level of deference and respect, but also familiarity. Like, these are all skills. And a lot of the people, I think, are not taught the skills. But I will say, when people are, you know, that I used to teach at Yale because I only taught at schools I couldn't have gotten into. and so my students, some of them were just phenomenal at a certain sort of what's known in prep school world as ease, the ability to sidle up to an authority figure in a way that feels cool, but is also completely suck up-y. So they were like so skilled at this, too skilled. But I think, you know, we could all learn these skills easily and save ourselves a lifetime of misery.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I have a similar experience. I went to a very bad school, a comprehensive school in the UK. And when I went into the world of journalism, started to meet people who'd been to the posh schools and had been to Oxford and Cambridge, I figured out, it seemed to me that what they'd learned wasn't really anything academic. It was this ease, as you put it, like they're this absolute confidence in themselves. And you just think, they could walk into any meeting and command respect. And it's like, where did you learn that? I wish I could learn that. So yeah, wonderful. I agree. I mean, to be taught this stuff at school would be wonderful. Next question is from Patricia. And Patricia asks, if adept social skills don't guarantee authenticity, how can we prioritize authenticity? I'm not sure I quite understand that question.
At least in my mind, it raises the issue: okay, is this all fake?
Yeah. Okay.
Like, is social skills make you're like play acting? Okay. And I guess my initial, I haven't thought too much about it, but it's a good question. Is none of us are that good actors? Mm. Maybe, you know, a few, Meryl Streep is that good an actor or somebody, but most of us, we do better being ourselves. So the process of really getting to know someone, you have to be willing to reveal yourself. In order to behold someone, you have to be willing to be beheld. And if in my dualism, if you're a diminisher and the other person's illuminator, then they're not going to be able to get you to see others. You're just all walled up. Mm. So if you're going to have a relationship, it has to be two people revealing vulnerably and honestly who they really are. And there has to be reciprocity. So I think it's one authentic self looking at another authentic self. Though I will say, when you really get to know people, you learn a lot more about who you are. I think one of the things I learned in the book is, for a lot of people, a lot of researchers think introspection is highly unreliable.
Yeah.
That when we look inside our own selves and try to tell the story about ourselves, mostly we're having intellectual breakthroughs that are fake, or else we're ruminating, we're just spiraling into ourselves. And so I think most of the researchers think, if you really want to know something about yourself, go out and talk to somebody else and then compare notes.
Yeah.
How do you see this? How do I see this?
Brilliant. Thank you, Patricia. Next question is really good. So Victoria asks, any advice on how to connect with a boss who is a diminisher? Or we could say anybody. You know, if we've got a diminisher in our lives, how do we cope with that?
Yeah, it's tough. It's a tough one. I start with curiosity into them, their life, and hoping they'll reciprocate with a little curiosity. The second thing is, I start by betraying a little vulnerability, not a lot, just a little. I'm uncertain about this, to see if they can sit there with you. Mm. And then I do the take me back technique. And just, we might be chatting and it's like, take me back to your childhood. Like, who were you as a kid? What'd you want to do? And I find people love talking about their childhood. And if those three techniques don't work, good luck. You know, I if somebody doesn't want to open up, and that means they're afraid of opening up, or they don't think it's proper, then I've found there's not much you can do. But I will say, as the person who's been in authority, I found just a little bit of vulnerability goes a long way. So I was teaching a class, it was like 10 years ago or so, or maybe 8 years ago. And the woman who is now my wife, I was courting her, and she was coming to New Haven to tell me whether she would marry me or not. And I didn't tell this to the class. I just said, I can't go to attend office hours tonight because I'm dealing with something personal. That's all I said. And that evening, of the 24 students in the seminar, about 18 emailed me and said, "Professor Brooks, I just want you to know I'm thinking about you. I'm praying for you." And that little bit of vulnerability changed the tenor of the class the whole term.
Wow.
Because I wasn't just austere Professor Brooks. I was just another schmo getting through life. And I think that in the workplace, we don't want to be completely spill our guts in the workplace. But in my view, most of us are not open enough. We should be a little more open than we are, and it'll improve the workplace.
And so the idea being that openness breeds openness, it hopefully will nudge into being a culture of a little bit more openness.
Absolutely, yeah. Right.
Okay, thank you, Victoria. That was a great question. So next from Kieran. So Kieran writes, "David, on your journey from being harsh stroke closed off to softer stroke more open, what were the reactions of the people around you? Did you lose people along the way? And how did you cope with this, especially in relation to your faith?"
Yeah, I don't think I lost too many people. There are some people I remember when I was getting more open, I did have conversations with friends and I found they just couldn't go there. Like, you know, I had one conversation, I recall, with a friend who's a foreign policy expert. And I think I started talking, I was going through a divorce, so I started talking about it over lunch. And it was as if I had set fire to his private parts. he just like, terror, terror. And so I think a lot of people go into public policy because they don't want to deal with private policy. And they're just avoiding what's inside. And so they go into public policy. They think they'll save the world without dealing with themselves. But I generally found my friendships were much deeper, and I learned things, like even last 2 weeks, this is not a friendship, it's sort of semi-professional relationship. I've had lunch over the years many times with a senator, and he's pretty very conservative Republican. And this time he happened to mention that his wife is really ill and dying. And it was just moving to see this side of a person. I had no clue about that side of a person. And I would say that's one of the rewards of going through life in this manner.
Yeah, yeah, wonderful. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Kieran. So next question is from Arnie. And Arnie asks, "Would you say that the most important thing about almost any relationship is that the other person makes you feel good about yourself and that you make them feel good about themselves?"
Yeah, or honest with about it. You know, I do think you have to, there has to be some feeling of, I mean, I say when I coach my students about how to think about the marriage decision, and one of my things I always say is a marriage is a multi-decade conversation. Pick someone you could talk to forever. But the other thing I say is love comes and goes, but admiration stays. So marry someone you admire, and that is a great part of marriage. But you don't want to practice what they call idiot compassion, which was nothing but positivity. There has to be some critiquing with care. And there's a saying I learned that when two people get married, or just even enter into a relationship, they start with stars in their eyes. And then about 6 months into the relationship, you realize that the other person is actually kind of selfish in many ways. And as you're making this realization about them, they're making it about you. And so the relationship is only going to work if both people decide, well, my own selfishness is the problem here, so I'm going to work on my own selfishness. That's the only selfishness I can really control. So you don't want to totally ignore the fact that we tend to be selfish creatures, and we want to acknowledge each other's selfish points and have honest conversations about it. But hopefully you do it in the context of unstinting and unconditional love.
Yeah, exactly. So honesty and authenticity, as well as the making people feel good about themselves. All right, thank you, Arnie. So this next question is from Anonymous. Ooh. How best can we balance being open and being self-protecting in cases where the other person has worked against you, or your instinct tells you that the other person does not have your best interests at heart? So how to know an enemy, yeah. You know, essentially.
Yeah, right. So I first want to thank Gordon Brown for the question. I'm just kidding. You know, it's a fair question. And my line is that it's a brutal world these days. But it's still practical to lead with trust.
Yeah.
And that people, if you lead with trust, most of the time people will show up for you and behave in trustworthy ways. Sometimes you'll be betrayed, but it's worth a price to be paid. And it's not naive to lead with curiosity. It's not practical to not understand the other people around you. So a lot of the stuff I'm talking about in the book may seem naive and woo-woo, but to me, even in these brutalizing times, the only solution, even if we're fighting over Gaza or we're fighting over whatever, Brexit or the Iraq War or anything, or Donald Trump, the only effective way to have a relationship in these brutalizing times is to lead with the kind of skills I'm talking about. Because once we detach the human connection, then we've really lost it. And so, for example, if we're arguing about something, there's probably something deep down that we agree upon. In the years gone by, when Brexit happened, you may be pro-Brexiteer, anti- or Remainer, you probably both want what's best for the people of Great Britain. And so if you can keep returning to the thing you actually agree upon, that gem statement, you save a relationship amid disagreement. And so there are techniques and skills for disagreeing well. And even in brutalizing times, I think it's worth it to lead with trust and then figure out how to disagree well.
Yeah, and I think sort of going back to some of the things you write about in How to Know a Person, that's where the narrative mode of inquiry is so helpful. Yeah. Because again, I found as a journalist that when you actually sit down in an open-hearted way and say, tell me your story to people that you don't agree with, I've written about actual Nazis, you know, Holocaust Nazis, you don't walk away agreeing with them, but you walk away thinking, okay, I can understand the story that you tell about the world. And often these people that begin, that seem like monsters when you meet them at a distance, they seem like humans who are just making a terrible mistake. So that, I think that's why the narrative mode that you describe is so valuable. Okay, so in the last couple of minutes, we've got one more question from another anonymous. The final question then, David, is it a human trait that we readily believe someone is caring and empathetic when they might not be? So is this a human kind of failing or trait that we are maybe credulous to other people's caring and empathetic?
It depends what we've learned. And so, you know, I do think, as I write in the book, that babies come out of the womb looking for a face to see them. Mm. That the first human quest is the quest for recognition.
Yeah.
And if some of you may have gone online and see these still-faced experiments where they take babies and they take moms and they tell moms not to emotionally react to anything their baby does. So the baby is bidding for attention and the mom just sits there still-faced. And if you watch these videos, for the first 5 seconds, the babies are sort of upset and curious. And then suddenly they're angry, furious, they collapse into agony. That if we don't feel seen, then we're just going to collapse into agony. And so I think we have this human need for recognition. But if it's been betrayed, if we've had relationships that have betrayed us, then we're going to see our world, our models will be filled with betrayal, and we'll see threat everywhere. And we'll see threat even when it doesn't exist. And so there's an organization in Baltimore that surrounds underperforming kids in the Baltimore schools with a bunch of volunteers to help them basically serve as extended families. And the kids have been betrayed so much by life, they push the volunteers away. And the rule of thread, this organization, is you keep showing up. There's no exit. Unless they get a court order, you're going to show up day after day at the door, knocking on the door, saying, let me take you to school. Here, I brought you some lunch. And one woman who works there said it's identity changing when somebody shows up for you after you've rejected them. And it's identity changing for the one who is rejected. And so that's altering, again, the models of the mind. Is the world trustworthy? Is the world trustworthy or is it not? And I think life teaches us an answer to that question one way or the other.
Wonderful. Oh, well, David, it's been such an amazing hearing you talk. And again, and thanks to everybody for showing up this evening or whatever time it is where you are showing up. If you haven't bought David's book yet, How to Know a Person, I'm sure you've got a taste of it over the last hour. It's a really wonderful thing. So go away and buy it if you haven't already. And thank you for being here with us today, tonight, David.
Well, it's been a pleasure, a real pleasure to get a chance to electronically meet you, and someday we'll do it over a pint.
Perfect. Thanks, David.
This episode starred David Brooks and was presented by Will Storr. You can buy David's new book from the How To Academy page of bookshop.org. When you do that, you'll be supporting our friends at local bookseller Primrose Hill Books, rather than a terrible mega corporation. Take a look at uk.bookshop.org/lists/how-to-academy-books. The link is also in the show notes. This show is produced by me and Nicole Wong. Our editor is John Doughty. How To Plus members could have watched and joined this live stream for free weeks ago, and many more live streams that don't ever feature on the public podcast. Consider buying a gift subscription for your intellectually curious friends and family, or maybe just pick one up for yourself. Find out more at howtoacademy.com. Until next time, I'm Vass Christodoulou. Thanks for listening.